Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Thursday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. As you know, we always Zoom before the show. We're really Zooming way before the Thursday show because we're Zooming on Tuesday afternoon. This show will air on Thursday, and in part because the debate is Tuesday night. And I want it to be as possibly au courant as possible. So Wednesday morning, we're Zooming early, and then Wednesday at noon, you'll get to hear the show. But as you've come to expect at the beginning of every show, as we've done since March of this year, we begin with the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman during the impeachment hearings of 2019. You know it. You've heard it every single day. You've got it probably memorized in your head. Maybe you're annoyed with me. Don't be annoyed with me. Have his voice ringing in your ears when you exercise the franchise in November of 2020. Whether you do it as a mail-in vote, whether you do it as absentee balloting, whether you do it in person, I don't care how you get there, just make sure the vote gets there. Anyway, now Lieutenant Colonel Vindman in the impeachment hearings of 2019.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
Colonel Vindman had an article in today's New York Times.
He did.
People should read it.
One of the great things about airing on KPFT in Houston, Texas, one of the stations that we're on in the Pacifica Network, is that we landed in Houston in part, and we landed in Texas because we were starting to do a show called Indictment Watch when Rick Perry was running for president for about 16 minutes. And as we were doing the show called Indictment Watch, we then met this fabulous, fabulous reporter from the Quorum Report known as Scott Braddock. And now Scott Braddock is a regular on our show every single damn week. And we know more about Texas, I think, than most Texans, because Scott is so phenomenal at both weaving the history of Texas and the politics of Texas and what is happening now and how as Texas goes, so goes the country. One of the things he's done, however, is expand the scope of people that I get to sort of hang out with in Texas. And one of those individuals, this is a long lead into introducing Glenn Smith. Glenn Smith is an author, an activist, a political consultant. He wrote for the Houston Chronicle. He worked for Ann Richards. He now consults for a lot of progressive Texans. And we are so grateful to have him on the air because, like Scott Braddock, he too has an arc of political history in Texas. And Texas has waxed and waned over your lifetime, Glenn Smith.
Yes, it
has. And I feel like we're on the precipice of change. And not just in the country, because we're looking at the changing demographics, and we're looking at climate change and the pandemic, but especially in Texas. You know, we keep thinking, is it going to happen in, 2024? Is it going to happen in 2028? But there is a real sense that maybe 2020 is the year that the Republicans have to start like becoming really frightened, because they might not even lose the presidency, i.e. with Donald Trump, not only nationally, but in Texas, but they might even lose the Texas legislature, which would be kind of shocking to Governor Abbott, who has been very comfortable in being able to sort of control all the political landscape. But you shared with me a story that just came out, and I have a copy of the story from USA Today. And I want you to thread this story, not only at the national level, but what it would obviously mean in Texas. The story was entitled, Trump Used Facebook to Suppress the Black Vote in Battleground States During 2016 Election, the report says. And the reason I love this story is that we actually blamed Hillary Clinton. We said that Hillary Clinton was so ho-hum that the reason why she didn't win is that she didn't get the kind of inspirational votes that we saw with Barack Obama. And yet this story suggests that the reason why we saw such a low turnout with Black voters in 2016 may not just have been attributed to Hillary Clinton, but it could in fact be attributed to what the Trump campaign did targeting Black voters. So one, welcome to the program and fill us in on this just breaking story, which just sort of adds to the mix of what's happening with the United States Supreme Court and Donald Trump's tax returns. And of course the debate that will have happened on Tuesday night. Welcome to the program.
Arnie, so happy to be here with you again. I love doing your show. So let's just jump right in. This story that's broken by Channel 4, the Great Britain's investigative unit at that wonderful place, detailed in a lot of detail, was able to review an enormous amount of data from Facebook and other places that show the targeted suppression efforts of the Trump campaign and, importantly, the Republican National Committee. It was an online version of things that the right wing has done for years and years and years, which is to give misleading information, especially to African-American voters and Hispanic voters here, state like Texas, they'll give them the wrong election dates. They'll say that they'll give them the wrong ballot locations. They'll say terrible things about the Democratic candidates and turn them off to those particular demographics. What's interesting about this to me today, beyond just the revelations of what Trump was doing in 16, and is no doubt doing right now in 2020, as the story also indicates, is that the Republican National Committee in 2016 was under a 35-year-old federal court order not to do it.
Wow.
They had gotten caught doing these things way back in the 80s, and they were under a federal court order, and they could not do these things, which meant in 2016, they were violating a federal court order. Now, what could be done legally about that today, I don't know. But it does indicate that lawlessness is in the playbook of the Republicans. They don't really care, right? And you're right when you point out that in 16, there was just there was like no reason for the African-American vote to dip like it dipped, honestly. Right. Something had to happen to cause that. And now we know what it was. It was intentional, misleading, disinformation, and other suppression tactics aimed right at them that knocked down their numbers in the election. So it happened all across the country.
Right, and they called it deterrence. That was what it was called. And deterrence was targeted at African-American voters. You know, in a way, my heart breaks for Hillary Clinton. It rarely does it break for Hillary Clinton, but right now my heart breaks for her. What we know going into the campaign in 2016 is that the person with the highest negatives in, I think, you know, polling history was Donald Trump. Sadly, the person with the second highest negatives going into 2016 was Hillary Rodham Clinton. So I think a lot of people just said, oh, look what, she didn't go to Michigan. She didn't go here. She didn't go there. Look at her high negatives. But now when you couple this with what we have found out about this 2016, you know, focus on the African-American voter and actually calling it deterrence, and you're seeing this enormous drop with African-American voters, it now begins to make sense, because you just can't blame Hillary. You just can't blame it. Now you know that the RNC was breaking the law, was targeting African-Americans in a way that was just obviously incredibly successful. And now the question is, what are they doing in 2020? Now, to be forewarned is to be forearmed. And how do we go into the African-American community and be able to sort of offer a counter narrative, or basically say, they're basically manipulating you, so screw them, here's the facts, that's what you don't trust. I mean, how do you deal with this? I'm hoping in some ways that the deterrent to the RNC, you know what it is? Black Lives Matter. That we now have a more engaged and more aware African-American community, because for them, everything is on the line in a way that they've always known, but now it has made such a collective stir on the American landscape.
Well, I think the first step is to shine a light on what the Republicans are doing and do it as loudly and as you can be done in the entire opinion sphere, and especially on those targeted demographics that the Republicans want to suppress and want to disenfranchise. And they use a variety of techniques to do that, just taking their voting rights away. So the more light we shine on it, the better chance we have of countering it, I think. When you go back to the 2016 post-election analysis, all of it was wrong. we have this information now about the voter suppression of the African-American vote. Right. But here's sort of, do you remember at the time how they said, this is because Democrats overlooked the economic anxiety of Midwestern white, right?
Yes.
Okay, so let's look at the news today. Now those Midwestern whites know that they're paying taxes that Donald Trump should be paying. They are paying for that deadbeat, right? So if economic anxiety was their motivation to be for Trump, this would blow it sky high. But that wasn't the motivation. The motivation was race then, and it's race today.
Wow. So again, this fills a gap in knowledge. It also helps us refocus who we were blaming for the failure of 2016. And I think that that's important information as we go into this election. I know people are already voting, but there are still, you know, millions that are going to have to sort of participate. The landscape is so incredibly fluid as we move forward. But the other thing is that I want to just challenge you a little bit. There is now a sophisticated cult following Donald Trump. I think in 2016, when they were voting for him, whether it was, you know, race or economic anxiety, whatever the excuse is, it was kind of a, pardon the expression, F you, to Congress, to politics, to sort of whatever had come before. Donald Trump has changed that. It is not just screw government, because Donald Trump is the government. Now it is about embracing the cult leader who can do no wrong. And even if they die from COVID-19, even if they've lost their job from COVID-19, even if the coal industry has not come roaring back like he promised, even if they're being burned out of their houses in Oregon and Washington, they now have so embraced the cult leader that facts and situation doesn't seem to matter.
No, it doesn't, but I don't disagree with that about the loyalty to the cult and to Trump, holding them fast. But I do think that the next thing that holds them is that he beats up people they want to see beaten up on their behalf.
Very good point. Right?
And as long as he does that, he's like the high school cult bully. As long as he's beating up the other kids, if some kids want to see beaten up, they're going to hang with that gang, right? And not take them on.
Go on, Ken.
But one thing that these white cult supporters of his are not going to be happy about, and Arnie raised it with this tax issue, they are not going to be the kind of people who like the idea that I'm paying my taxes. I bellyache a lot about having to pay my taxes, but this son of a gun got away with paying nothing. And are we going to forgive that? I don't know.
I hate to break it to you. So I've hung out with these people. Okay. I used to do commercial radio. I used to be on the Rush stations. I lived in the northern part of my state where a lot of the people that you're just describing can live. And here's what they think. They think they're impressed with the fact that he didn't pay taxes. They want to be like him. You see, they don't realize that taxes pays for their schools and taxes pays for their water and taxes pays when FEMA comes in because there was a flood in Houston. They don't calculate that. They think they've done everything on their own. Screw government. And the fact that he was so good at not paying his taxes just proves what kind of an effective leader he is. I wish it translated into, oh my God, the SOB, you know, he didn't serve, he doesn't pay, we pay, and that they get angry at him. Instead, my fear is, Glenn, they kind of admire that, the way they admire the fact that he beats up Black people.
Yeah, they've said as much in focus groups, et cetera, over
the
years.
They have.
And when questions were raised about the taxes that Trump didn't pay, as it turns out, another angle in a news story out today about the Texas situation, it's really another one in Great Britain. I'll take a second to detail it.
Okay.
It's about his property, the golf course at Aberdeen, Scotland.
Right.
And so the British authorities have a lot more regulatory scope over properties like that. And so you have to give them a lot more detail about what you've spent on them, invested in them, et cetera, right? So here come these income tax forms here. And what Trump was doing, Trump was putting his millions of dollars into the Aberdeen golf course and never spending it there, however, and it was just disappearing, and he'd use the money to raise the appraised value of the golf course. That is classic money laundering. So on paper, he was putting the money into the golf course, and then it's leaving because if he'd actually done any improvements, that had to be reported to the authorities, and it was not reported ever. So it was money laundering on his or someone else's behalf, and I'd watch for that story to grow over the coming days and weeks.
I've got so many questions about this tax information that it should land now. Where did they get it? I've got all these questions in my head. I mean, it's almost like if somebody was plotting out a movie, this is exactly the day you want to drop the New York Times story on the taxes. This is right before the debate that you want to do this. And I think you're absolutely right. But the other thing I kind of always wanted to say to those people in the focus groups who are like applauding Donald Trump for not paying taxes and they want to be just like him. And that is that you almost want to ask them, and then how would you get to work? And they look at you and you go, what? Well, I just want to know, are you paying for the road? And then I want to say to them, and how would you educate your kid? You know, so you applaud Donald Trump for paying zero, but zero wouldn't get you a teacher. Zero wouldn't get you a cement block. Zero won't get you a FEMA truck. Zero won't get you. So if you all want to be like Donald Trump, what island are you going to? I mean, I want a reporter or a focus group person to damn push back and see how they respond. Because that's part of the problem. They did a story, Glenn, many, many years ago. I think it was on PBS. And what they did was they woke someone up in the morning and the question was, does government affect your life? Oh, absolutely not. Absolutely not. I've never had to depend on government. And then what they did was they followed them through the next 12 hours. And every time they were in some setting where government touched their lives, they turned on the water. Oh, guess what? Clean water. They switched on the electricity. Oh, a regulated utility. They opened up their refrigerator. Oh, the FDA has approved your food. They got on the bus. And over the course of 12 hours, the number of times government had touched their lives would make your mind explode. Okay? Your mind explode. But they had to go to that level to explain to people what they think doesn't exist, but in some ways is invisible because it is so seamless in their lives. And that's my problem with Democrats, and that's my problem with government, is that we never celebrate and inform people what it is we do to make their lives better and let them become successful.
I have some good news for you. So let's come back to Texas for a minute.
Okay.
So everybody for a long time has preached that it was going to be demographic shifts here in Texas that turned us blue over time. It's turning out that it's changes in the opinion of white voters in suburban Texas that it's happening first. And then we have a chance of taking the state house, as you noted earlier. It's because those suburban Anglos are looking back at Democrats going, fix this. And what is it they really want fixed besides the world Trump has created? It's the failure of Republicans on infrastructure for a long period of time. Right. Schools have deteriorated, bridges have deteriorated, roads have, transportation's in a tank here in Texas because Republicans haven't spent any money on it. And now the people that depend on those things, you don't have to persuade them with words because it's happening in their front yards. They can see it happen. And they're going, who's responsible for this? And it's the Republicans. And one other note about that, that when this bill comes due to them, one of the things Republicans have been able to pull off in campaign settings now for a couple of three decades here is the consequences of the policies aren't known for years and years and years. So when they cut taxes on the rich, the consequences of that aren't known for 10 or 15 years, right? Because the money got spent overnight on it. And so it sounds good. It's good, you know, it's good campaign rhetoric. But now the consequences are known. And so we don't have to persuade them so much as point out that the reason their streets are deteriorated and they're afraid of the bridge to get to work and they don't have public transit like they should have is all because of the Republicans. And that's made a big difference.
So one thing Scott has taught me is the number of people that are coming in on a daily basis and moving to Texas. The number is mind-boggling, you know? Just check the U-Haul trucks, you know, that go into Texas. And so a lot of people go to Texas because of opportunity. A lot of people go to Texas because it's like they think of it as a tax-free state and as a more conservative state. So there might be that kind of a welcome mat. But they don't come from Texas. They may come from places like California, or they may come from places that actually have a greater investment in infrastructure. They may actually have a more sort of progressive or liberal approach to governing. And even though they think they hate it, they get to Texas and they think, well, they can do it in Texas with no money. And then they get there and they go, what do you mean you haven't fixed the bridge? Mm-hmm. What do you mean you haven't improved your school? What do you mean? I mean, all of a sudden, what they hated about California, and they think they're going to find in Texas nirvana without having to pay the bill, is that they get the worst of everything. They've moved, and then the theory that they moved on turned out not to be a reality. And that is, yeah, Texas is booming, but it's booming in such a way that it's failed to make the necessary investments to actually sustain not only the boom, but to make life safe and secure for people that live in those suburbs.
Yeah, and another thing they discovered really quickly is if they're going to be two family earners, right, that there may be a good economic road for one of those two, but not for the other one. So in right. California, you know, where let's reverse the classic gender roles there. Let's say the wife's in high tech and the husband is a public school teacher. They're both right. earning really good money. Right. When they get here, the school teacher doesn't earn any money. Right. So they can't, even if they think it's cheaper here, relatively speaking, it costs them more because they're earning less as a family. And they find that out pretty quickly.
Yeah. Ken, you want to weigh in?
Well, I just wanted to go back briefly to your point, Glenn, about the effects of these tax cuts and other conservative bills aren't seen until later. One thing that politicians at the federal and state levels do quite regularly, which is smart politics, but really hiding the ball for the American public, is that they don't have big budget deficits in the first year or the second year of those tax cuts for the rich. So the country, they can tell their voters at the next election, you know, the budget deficit didn't go up and it's okay. But in the out years, that's when the government is really going to have the shortfall. And, you know, there's these huge deficits, but hopefully they're not going to be in power anymore. They don't have to worry about that election.
That's what happened in Kansas, right?
Right, exactly. Exactly.
When they slashed taxes dramatically, like percentage-wise, most any state had ever done, and it took a year, two, 3 years before the deficit card, they realized no more money for schools. And that's what I mean. The consequences are so
Congress delayed. Does that too.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, Congress does that too.
Yeah, I mean, they probably got away with it.
So I want to get a little bit into what's going to happen with this election in Texas, because we keep thinking maybe there's the possibility that things may change. Republicans are clearly petrified about that. There's no question. They're smelling it, which kind of explains why the chairman of the Republican Party in Texas is now trying to sue the governor of Texas, both of whom are Republicans, because the Republican governor, Governor Abbott, expanded the number of weeks that you could vote prior to the election. It used to be 2 weeks early voting, and he made it 3. So technically, my understanding is maybe it was a little bit loosey-goosey that he did this by an executive order. But the Republicans are saying, we don't want you to vote absentee. We don't want you to vote by mail. We don't want to somehow expand, you know, early voting. It's kind of shocking because their people die too from COVID. Their people actually want to use and have historically used absentee balloting. Their people have done it. I mean, how confused are Republicans about what to do about exercising the franchise? I mean, if there's a mixed message coming out of any party, it ain't the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party is just basically saying, if you have to swim to vote, you swim. But the Republican Party keeps changing its methodology every 16 seconds. And if I was a Republican, I'm like, what's the direction here?
That's like you saw Trump go to Florida and say, vote by mail, everybody, because Florida, the elderly people who vote Republican often vote by mail, right? Here, one thing about the Governor Abbott here in his extended early vote period, I think we need to keep in mind that he was also trying to give additional opportunity to Republican voters who have been scared away from voting by mail by his president.
Exactly.
So it wasn't like Abbott was trying to do Democratic voters a favor. He was trying to do Republican voters a favor, because he was doing that at the same time he's been clamping down every other possible way on the right to vote, and including being against the mail ballot expansion, right? So, yeah, it looks contradictory, but it's really not on that. I think it's all part of one insidious plot, actually.
Well, but what's interesting is, but Governor Abbott got a lot of, you know, national recognition for doing what he did, because as I told Scott Braddock, he threaded the needle. So he didn't want to expand absentee balloting. We already know if you're over 65, you can do mail-in voting. All right, that's the story in Texas. He didn't want to change that. He just wanted to make it possible for old people. But at the same time, he is somewhat aware of COVID-19. He realizes that it is kind of a problem, all right? And by doing this, by expanding early voting by an extra week, he kind of was acknowledging that he didn't want people to be on long lines in order to vote, given the fact that we have COVID-19. And he got a lot of, you know, positive response from the national media because he was able to sort of be this mugwump, you know, give everybody a little bit of everything they want. And then you've got the Republican Party in Texas going, screw you, we're suing you. Oh my God. The Texas, I mean, even Texas Republicans don't even know what agenda they want to embrace.
Well, it's, I think the attention Abbott got, what I'm trying to say, was a little misplaced. I don't think there was any needle to be threaded. I think he is trying to make voting easier for older voters he assumes are going to vote Republican. All right. Yeah. I think that was all there was to the extended early voting period. It wasn't necessarily to help Democrats. And maybe it did was done with some awareness of, mm-hmm. of the dangers of COVID. Mm-hmm. That would be pretty cynical since he's opening the schools and forcing essential workers into situations where we're about to get another spike here. But, you know, it's Abbott. What do you expect?
All right, so let's talk about COVID and healthcare. Texas has the highest percentage of uninsured people in the United States. Let me repeat that statistic. Texas has the highest percentage of uninsured people in the United States. Texas did not embrace expanded Medicaid. I am kind of curious, are there any regrets about not expanding Medicaid, given the fact that now we have this pandemic, and the pandemic is spiking once again in Texas, and might even grow even farther because as a result of the fact that there's been sort of this lack of direction and an ability to clamp down, and we haven't gotten the vaccine, and we aren't really able to treat it. I am wondering how healthcare will also be playing out in this 2020 election in Texas. You mentioned that the suburban white women or suburban folks are beginning to now move away from the Republican Party. And you mentioned it because they don't have the requisite investment. What about healthcare? Some of those suburban people had to have lost their job. Some of those suburban people have to start worrying about the people that their kids are going to school with that don't have access to healthcare. And because of COVID-19, the one thing they do want them to do is to be healthy because they could actually get their kids sick and then bring the sickness home. I'm wondering how the healthcare story plays out politically in Texas.
Still number one is the issue of concern to Texas voters.
Wow.
By a large margin. So it has a huge impact on this. And as we read news that it's likely this Supreme Court could well overturn the ACA, putting even more people without health care and health insurance. It's a very frightening prospect. Here, because of our large number of uninsured already, it could be devastating. A lot of business people, a lot of hospitals and healthcare people here are still stunned that we haven't taken the expanded Medicare money from the federal government because it has to get made up, in some cases, by local taxpayers. You mentioned during the middle of a pandemic, because these people lack access to health care, you're going to come in contact with more infected people. Exactly. More people are going to go untreated. I want to say real quick about that. I know we're going to run out of time here really quickly. I've noticed during the course of this pandemic and, say, the anti-maskers, I really do believe there's a significant number of Americans who simply do not know their actions can affect others. It's not that they know it and don't care.
They still don't know.
They think the mask was all about protecting themselves, right?
And they don't realize it's someone else.
They just don't get that. They can't.
You know why they don't get that? Because they're watching Fox and they're listening to Trump. And when you're watching Fox and you listen to Rush and you listen to Trump, guess what? It's a trifecta of lies. Yep. So if they don't expand their knowledge base, it's because there's no way they can because they won't turn the dial. But I don't want to turn the dial because I got to say goodbye to Glenn Smith. Glenn, please join us as often as possible. And let's see if we can turn Texas around in November of 2020.
Good luck. Take care. We'll see you soon.
Okay, ciao. This is The Attitude with Ernie Arnesen and producer Ken Barnes. We'll be right back.
Hypocrite, you dirty hypocrite. You're gonna pay the price someday. Hypocrites, all of you hypocrites. You're gonna pay the price someday. We're just
Watch out. Hi, this is Arnie Arneson. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. This is the second half of what will now be the Thursday edition of The Attitude. So as you know, one of my favorite sites is theconversation.com. And for those of you who've never been to The Conversation, go, go, go. It produces fabulous articles by PhDs and professors from around the country. A lot of these people, you know, they talk to their students. They might write in academic journals, but this is now more user-friendly. And as a result, I've gotten together a great stable of fabulous professors from around the country who've been willing to talk with us on The Attitude. Joining us right now is Gary Painter. He's a professor of public policy at the University of Southern California. And he wrote a piece, and the title of the piece was, How Even a Casual Brush with the Law Can Permanently Mar a Young Man's Life, Especially If He Is Black. So let me welcome Professor Painter to the program. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Arnie. It's good to be here.
So, Gary, my audience has heard me tell the story, but I'm going to share this story with you, which will explain why I really wanted to grab you. Mm-hmm. And that is, I told the story about being a young legislator and attending a conference. And during the course of the conference, we had a majority leader from Illinois or Indiana sitting at the table. And it had to be maybe 1988, 1990. And we were talking about the prison system in our state, you know, and how many people were warehousing and what could we do about good time and that kind of stuff. And he suddenly chirped up and said, you know how we plan prison beds in our state? And we all looked at him and said, no. He said, we go into the second grade class and we count the number of children at risk. And based on that number, we plan future prison beds. The gasp at the table was audible. Someone went, there's seven. There's seven. You've written them off at seven. And I have never forgotten that story. And as I read your piece, I wanted to remind folks that, you know, when we think of Black Lives Matter, we think about the horrific situations that have happened where a cop has killed someone who happens to be African-American, and only because we have the video, or only because we have the legal counsel, or only because there's an outpouring of response, that we are now becoming aware that this is not a unique situation. What you write about, however, is in some ways more insidious, because there will not be a video camera to necessarily talk about this. There will not be an outpouring in the streets, but this has an enormous impact, especially on the African American community. So will you share with my audience about this quote unquote casual brush with the law and what its impact is, especially on African Americans?
Well, first, Arnie, to be honest, I have to sit with the story that you shared and just recognize how horrific that is. And it's in many ways, you know, all your listeners, even if they've heard it before, they do need to hear it again, because it does show where society's focus ought to be and where it may have been in that moment for that particular person that shared that. And so that is just shocking and horrifying. I think that when people use phrases, for instance, like systematic racism, it seems quite amorphous to them. Like, what do we mean by systematic racism? I don't feel it, especially if I'm a white person. You know, I don't know what that means. And so I think what's really critical is to bring to people information on what is that systematic racism and what are its consequences. And so that systems have actually kind of grown up, and in particular, the research that we're looking at here is what is the impact of having that casual brush with the law, having been arrested, having been convicted, having served your time and are now leaving jail, in terms of your future employment prospects. And, you know, you could tell the same or similar stories if you're looking at people who are trying to get housing. And I can happy to go off, you know, my own research can speak to that as well. But this particular piece was focused on the fact that if you, you know, in especially if you roll back the clock 15, 20 years, you know, you would have to check a box on an employment form that said, have you ever been arrested? Right. And that has then led to a movement around Ban the Box, which we can talk about. But what happens is that, you know, you know, up to a certain point, people have the authority to run a criminal background check on you. And the way the system is set up in many places, although laws are changing, but they're not, in many places we've also seen in the research, the law changes faster than the actual implementation of the law, so that people who are arrested and not even convicted are showing up and being flagged. And then you have the other side, which is the employer, the person hiring, who, you know, is confronted with that information. And they're confronted with information that someone's been arrested. And because we know from research that Black men in particular are 7 times more likely to be arrested than white men, they're going to have to make a decision as a hiring manager about whether to take in and process that information and let it influence the next step in a hiring process, or are they going to look beyond that information and to really think hard about, you know, not just talking to the person asking them, well, were you ever convicted? Right. And sometimes it doesn't even get to that point, but instead to investigate further to see if this person is the right match for the job, the skills does this person have. And so we know that each one of those little barriers, you know, from being arrested and getting flagged for arrest, being convicted, being flagged for conviction. And again, as I noted before, there are laws that are saying, no, we shouldn't have that on records anymore. We should expunge those records, especially if someone has paid their time. But the reality is, research has shown that a lot of those sorts of marks on one's record persist for far longer than they ought to. And so what inspired this research that we've done in partnership with a nonprofit that focuses their work in Oakland, South LA, and South Chicago, is to really work hard with employers and to really kind of shift their systems, because they built systems around what the public sector did, which was to create these, you know, criminal background checks for various purposes. They weren't actually designed for employment decisions, but then they were used for employment decisions and for housing decisions. And so now the HR departments of many corporations are being confronted with, well, how do we change? Should we change? And many of them that we talked to said, we don't actually want to have this impact our hiring process, but our systems are set up so that it is a, you know, a moment in the hiring process. And so that's kind of where our work sits. And the reason that I wrote this piece is to really highlight the fact that it's not just about convictions. It's not just about incarceration. It's actually about even arrests that can, you know, change the trajectory of one person versus another. And this is, you know, so much more important, especially for Black men who are arrested 7 times more likely than white men.
Ken has heard me say this before, but if I ever ran for election again, I ran for governor, I ran for Congress. But if I ran a third time, my entire campaign would be do the math. Okay. And the reason I'm saying that is I want to go to your math, because you actually do numbers, and numbers are very powerful things. And you write, it's under the paragraph entitled Devastating Consequences. Now, please let me just read two or three of your sentences. 1 in 3 Americans has been arrested by the age of 23. 1 in 3 Americans has been arrested. Is that, I mean, just that means like you sit in a classroom and you look to your left and you look to the right and one of you will be arrested. I mean, it's just, it's shocking when I saw that number. But then you got even more frightening. But the stats get a lot worse if you are a Black man. A young African-American is 7 times more likely to get arrested than a white peer. By the time they are 23, Black men are at a 49% risk of getting arrested and 6 times more likely to be incarcerated than white men. As of 2010, 1/3 of African-American adult males had a felony conviction on their record. 1/3 of all African-American adult males, not a misdemeanor, this is a conviction, right, Gary? I mean, you were talking about the fact that they maybe don't have a conviction, they were just arrested. Right. This is a conviction on their record compared with just 8% of all U.S. adults. And again, I am so sensitive to this information, in part because it was something I had done when I was in the legislature. But again, my audience has heard me say this. I had a young African-American law student come to live with me a couple of years ago. This is white Concord, New Hampshire. This is white New Hampshire. This is the state that was the last state to pass Martin Luther King's birthday. Trust me, racism is alive and well in my state. We just don't have a lot of Blacks to basically target our racism at. When he moved in, you know what I had to do? I didn't have to do the talk with him. I had to do the talk with my neighbors. Mm-hmm. I had to let my neighbors know that a young African-American male was living with me, because as you just pointed out, it isn't even the conviction. He could have been stopped. They could have called the cops mm-hmm. on him. I didn't want that to happen because he was going to law school. He lived with me. I was embracing him like my son. But that's part of really what your story is about. These stories about felonies are huge, but it's not even, you have to get to the felony. It's just getting to the stop.
That's right. I mean, I think in one part, the reason I wanted to highlight the statistic that said 1 in 3 Americans, other studies have been, you know, kind of in the range of 30%, but there is research that shows that arrests are actually fairly frequent. So it's not like that this doesn't affect others. So I wanted to really highlight to everybody who might be listening or reading this piece to say, look, this affects a giant swath of our country. However, it disproportionately affects Black people. And I think this is true when we, again, think about the term systematic racism. It's at every stage there's disproportionality. So it's at the stop stage, it's at the arrest stage, it's at the conviction stage, it's at the incarceration stage, it's at the sentencing stage. At each one of those steps, we see disproportionality where Black people who are arrested and convicted, et cetera, end up with longer terms for the same crimes. They're more likely to be convicted for the same crimes. And, you know, they're more likely to be stopped and arrested at the beginning. So in that context, and there's research on every one of those stages, which documents disproportionality, it isn't a surprise then that there are challenges that Black people face when they are looking for jobs, when they're looking for housing. And it's because of that, essentially, this piece of the criminal justice system that has provided additional barriers, again, at every stage. And I think that's what people, I think, don't fully resonate with, is that they kind of think about kind of the big picture and just kind of, well, it doesn't make sense that there's these inequalities and gaps. You know, I treat people the same way. I believe everyone should be treated the same way, but you really have to break it down to every stage in order to unravel the challenges that Black people face.
But it's not only just about the unemployment. I mean, another number that I think is so important, and I used to hang out with folks at the Salvation Army, and when you leave prison, they usually give you like $50 and they tell you to go get a wardrobe so you can get a job. You know what it is? And I would be at the Salvation Army when they would come in, because the state prison wasn't too far away, and I would realize what they were doing. And I'm going, you're looking for a job? You can't wear that. You're looking for a job? You can't wear that. But this is what I think is even more frightening. 60% of formerly incarcerated individuals remain unemployed 1 year after being released, and those who find jobs make 40% less in pay annually. You want to know why there's recidivism? I mean, if you are going to be unemployed, what do you live on, air? And if you're going to be employed at 40% less than you would have earned if you hadn't, where do you live? Where do you find an apartment? How do you buy food? Mm-hmm. What's your transportation? I mean, people have to look at the gestalt. It's not just that you got out of prison and it's your fault because you didn't find a job, because obviously you have a record. But take a look at what you're doing. Mm-hmm. You're driving them back into the arms of incarceration because the system has set them up to fail.
No, that's right. And then on the housing side, to go even further, you can't move back in with a family member who might be able to provide you, you know, housing if they're receiving, you know, a variety of government subsidies. You know, and so then in that sense, then you could become homeless because you aren't able to join or rejoin a family member because of a conviction. So it is absolutely essential to understand what are these stages. And these are stages that the government can act. Now, you know, to the point where, you know, we talked a little bit about Ban the Box earlier. You know, this was, I think, a really important policy tool, is to say, listen, we shouldn't have an actual intake form that forces someone to self-identify as having an arrest on their record. Instead, most states who have passed Ban the Box laws now require that you talk to someone first, and then it's only when you're about to make an offer that you can do a criminal background check. However, it turns out that this is, you know, researchers have noted that sometimes hiring managers are going to make inferences about whole populations based on the fact that now they can't actually ask questions about criminal background check because they've been you know, so sensitized to believing that there is this disproportionality, which we know there is, that they actually then make what we call statistical discriminating decisions, because they're making assumptions about what background someone has. And so what was really clear in the research that we're doing is that it's not just about a single policy lever that needs to be switched, but instead a whole ecosystem that has to be shifted. And there are consequences beyond employment, obviously, by eliminating disproportionality and actually enforcing expungement when appropriate. But you also have to work with hiring managers so that they can actually change their practices, so they know how to hire people appropriately, they know how to onboard them appropriately, and ultimately to expand their talent pool to reach, you know, a lot of creative people that currently aren't able to engage in a normal job.
In addition, though, to hiring people follow appropriate rules of what is how to judge people in hiring them, you got to really change their mindset. Because as you said, and this is what I was going to say earlier, yeah, there is a disparity in many more people of color winding up incarcerated. But why is that? You see the videos of cops stopping people for no reason, and they're disproportionately black, you have racial profiling, and then people of color are appropriately afraid of cops because they get beaten more often and shot more often. So they try to run away or something, and then they're charged with more crimes, including disobeying a police officer, et cetera. They are more likely to wind up in jail for all of these reasons. And even going back to Arnie's seven-year-old, you know, all of these reasons that black people are more likely to end up in jail. And yet the mindset of white America, we with the privilege, we white privileged people, including the hiring directors, think, well, there are more black people in jail, there must be more criminals. So if I can't get a criminal record check, I'm just going to not hire the black applicants and hire the white ones. And I've been an employment discrimination lawyer and housing discrimination lawyer all my career, and it's very easy for a sophisticated employer to make discriminatory decisions without actually acknowledging them and being able to prove it.
No, that's right. And that's why, again, I come back to kind of helping us define what systematic racism is in this context. And so if you can really appreciate at each step where discrimination is happening, leading to disproportionality, then you can begin to unwind those practices. But, you know, perhaps as horrible as the seven-year-old story that you shared, Arnie, at the beginning of our conversation, you realize that if it is at, you know, we simply talked about five steps here today of where there's disproportionality, each one of those steps takes significant work and change. And it's not just about policy change, but it is also about a mindset change. With, for instance, hiring managers. The positive piece of the research that we're doing is that we're actually seeing that many hiring managers want to take that shift. They actually want to make sure that their hiring practices are more inclusive. They really care to, you know, about reaching the local community and hiring those folks first. They actually, though, because of the systems that have been put in place, they don't actually know how to do so. They haven't had practices that are very clear about how to go about doing this. And so it begins at the recruiting. In the second step is the hiring process, and the third step is the onboarding. And so what we're trying to do at the Center for Social Innovation, at the Price Center for Social Innovation, is to be able to figure out ways that we can actually create piloting and scaling of promising practices. And we recognize this is not going to happen in 1 minute. It's not going to happen in 1 day. It's not going to happen in a month. This is actually going to take some years, because we didn't put these practices in place over just simply a month or a year, but they've been in place for decades. And so okay, it's going to take a long time.
I'm going to make a recommendation for you. And I know where you should go. And here's
Tell me, Arnie.
Okay, you should go to the business schools. I want to know where the HR people are being trained. And the reason I say that, because I've had experience with that. I remember when I was at Harvard, they brought in a group of like senior executives to have some big powwow. And I was supposed to entertain the spouses of the senior executives, as you know, like the politician in recovery that was there. And so it was like 99.9% women and one guy, okay? And so I asked the question, did their husbands' companies have maternal leave for pregnancy? You know, was there a program for that? You know, for parental leave, not female, parental leave. Oh, yes. Okay. And then I looked at the women and I said, really? Did your husband stay home when you were pregnant? When you delivered, did he stay home? I said, so I'm just telling you right now, if he didn't stay home, the message was sent to all senior management, you don't either. So it's one thing to have a policy, and it's another thing to practice the policy. Mm-hmm. And so I was kind of challenging those spouses to actually send the message to their husbands that if you really believe in this parental leave policy, then you better freaking take it, okay? And that's one of the reasons why, as you're talking about a lot of these HR people and these people in management want to do the right thing. Well, part of the way you begin to inspire the right thing is that as they go through business school, that we make it part of the conversation. When you're making these decisions, what are you making a decision on? And I think that, again, we somehow forget to assume that you teach this. And that is a wonderful place to at least reinforce what you're doing with the people that you're working with right now or already in the system. They're not in school anymore. They have the hiring and firing capacity. But I think also it needs to trickle into the system where they get educated.
I think you're right, Arnie, and I'll even blame my profession. And my PhD is in economics. And so certainly those of us in economics have influenced those who are in business schools. And one of the things that we're taught about discrimination is that it shouldn't be profitable in the long term to discriminate. And therefore, you know, it should, you know, the people who discriminate are going to have a smaller talent pool than the people who don't. And therefore, they're actually going to, you know, eventually get weeded out. And we're going to left with a marketplace where discrimination doesn't happen. And that makes sense if you believe in one conception of economics. But John Nash came along, and many people have seen The Beautiful Mind, and he noted that, you know, he has this famous line in that movie that says, Adam Smith got it wrong. And I don't think actually John Nash ever said that, but it was good for the movie. And the point there was that you can actually engage in systems of strategic behavior that will reinforce what us as economists would call a discriminating equilibrium, where people with power and privilege continue to maintain their power and privilege over those who don't have it. And it actually is more profitable for, you know, particular groups. And in this case, the owners of capital are predominantly white, the hiring managers are predominantly white, et cetera. And so that's, you know, in part, you know, a bane of my own profession as an economist. You know, I'm in a public policy school, but it doesn't mean that I don't know what my profession is doing over in the business schools as well. But I agree with you. Your point is well taken that we have to teach properly so that people can understand what it is that actually leads to what I would call effective outcomes. So it's not about necessarily efficient. It's not just talking about a trade-off between efficiency and equity, but I think it's talking about what's just and effective.
I was studied economics. I said the same thing you just said to Joe Stiglitz before he made the conversion from just a mathematical economist to actually realizing that there are human beings involved. But the fact is, all economic analysis assumes that all the assumptions are true, the assumptions that we live in a perfect world, and you make accommodations for imperfect market power and imperfect information or something like that. But I was involved in a big lawsuit in New York in the city of Yonkers where their expert economists testified that the non-dispersive, the density of all the public housing in the black area of the city could be due to non-discriminatory ways. And I started asking them, the analysis doesn't work if you don't have your assumptions met. And one of the assumptions is you're not discriminating. And the judge looked at them and said, you assume that there's no discrimination, and then you prove at the end of your analysis that there's no discrimination. The economists assume away the world and then prove whatever they want to prove.
Yeah, but Gary, in your article, I go back to the math. What you say is the effect on the U.S. economy as a whole is significant. We're talking about what's happening when you come out of prison. Mm-hmm. With the underemployment of formerly incarcerated individuals leading to a loss of $78 billion to $87 billion in gross domestic product in 2014 alone. So let's do a ka-ching, okay? I mean, you know, I understand that the wealthier thing, but these people are probably underemployed or not working. That means that they're not buying your widget. That means they're not buying your car. That means they're not moving into, you know, that rental project that you want. So that is a loss to the rich. It's not just a loss to those individuals who are underemployed or without a job. We all are losing. The tax structure is losing. They're losing. I mean, again, nobody expands the math. I used to teach mass communication, and I always told my students, I would tell them, I'd say, I want you to look on your computer. I want you to look on your desk, and I want to put your hands down. When you put your hands right next to your eyes and you look at your desk, what do you see? And they may have saw a couple of holes and they saw a pen. I said, okay, move your hands out a little bit farther. What do you see? Oh, you see the whole desk. Okay, I want you to move your hands out even farther. What do you see? Oh, you see the classroom. And that's part of the problem, is that we have to have people move their hands out far enough so they actually see the big picture, because it's too convenient to just see the small now focus when you need the bigger picture to get the real analysis.
That's right. I mean, but if you think about splitting that $78 billion over, you know, kind of a very small subsample of very rich people, you know, what they lose individually is such a small piece of their overall wealth that it isn't in their best interest to kind of change how they deploy capital. And so it really does take a much broader set of structures to shift. And I think, again, part of its information and some of the work that we're doing and is written up in this piece is to get the information out there so people can actually wrestle with the facts. And I also think, again, why did I start with the 1 in 3 being arrested as an important stat, is to realize that this is actually affecting a lot more people than we think. It is absolutely disproportionately affecting communities of color. But, you know, this is a big enough issue, and those numbers are big enough, $87 billion, $78 billion, that it should shake us a bit, and we should ask ourselves if we should do something different. And that's what I hope we do.
Well, I am over the moon that we found you, Gary Painter. Thank you so much for writing this at The Conversation.
Thanks for doing the work you do.
That's exactly right. How even a casual brush with the law can permanently mar a young man's life, especially if he's Black. Join us again. It was a pleasure.
Thank you, Arnie. It's a pleasure to be here.
Ciao. This is the Thursday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. We'll schmooze tomorrow. Ciao. Whoa, oh, mercy, mercy me. All things ain't what they used to be now. Where did all the blue skies go? Poison is the wind that blows from the north and south and east. Whoa, mercy, mercy me. All things and what they used to be, oil wasted on the oceans and upon our seas, fish full of mercury. Oh, mercy, mercy me. All things and what they used to be.